As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hi there, thank you so much for joining us. This is this week's Zonal Marking Podcast, a tactical, analytical podcast brought to you by The Athletic, with me, Ali Maxwell, joined as always by my co-hosts and colleagues and friends, Tom Warville and Michael Cox. Tom, how are you getting on this week? What have you been working on?
What have I been working on? There's been a piece that's come out today on Emi Buendia with Michael Bailey, a player who I'm a really big fan of. And Michael essentially was looking at what Norwich are like with and without Buendia, which I think when we did the Bad Stats pod, we kind of firmly put with or without your stats in room 101. But I think Michael's gone about it a really nice way, and we've got some neat stats on how Buendia changes the way Max Aarons plays and changes the way that Norwich plays. So that's a big one. And then the rest of the week, I'm looking at the Champions League, something that Michael and myself are teaming up for ahead of next week's round of 16 kicking off again.
Nice. Bang up for that Buendia piece. One of my favourite players to cover in the EFL. Creative. He's added more of a goal threat this year and still picking up a ton of yellow cards. He's been sent off twice already this season as well. Michael, what's been on your agenda? How are you doing as well?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, was doing a piece about Phil Foden for Monday on the back of his really, really good performance in the win over Liverpool. And now this isn't being published until next week, but looking ahead to the Champions League and that coming back with some previews of the team, the teams involved. And also there's a thing on Ancelotti, which is going up, should be today if you listen to this on Wednesday, which is part of our reader request series where they can basically request articles from us. And someone wanted a kind of history of Carlo Ancelotti's tactics. So that is going up on the site. Yeah, Wednesday.
Nice, that's cool. I think some of the teams involved in the Champions League knockout stages might get mentioned and covered a little bit on today's podcast, which I'm really excited about. Before I tell you about the topic, reminder that if you are not a subscriber of The Athletic, that means you can't read what Michael and Tom are writing, and it's certainly worth checking out if you're a fan of the sort of things that we cover with these guys on this podcast. So sign up today, theathletic.com/zonal marking. You can sign up for £3.99 a month and hoover up all and everything that Tom and Michael write and their very talented colleagues as well. Now, I'm going to introduce the topic this week because it was my idea, my brainchild, which is unusual, which is rare. But basically, I was thinking over the weekend about our Overachievers podcast from around the mid-November time. We looked at some of the teams towards the top of the big five leagues across Europe who had started really hot. And I asked you guys to tell me whether they were there to stay or whether they were overachievers. It's interesting to look back at that group of teams. I mean, on the one hand, one of them was Rangers, who are still winning almost every game and cantering towards the league title. but also Sassuolo in Serie A. We enjoyed taking a look at them. Since then, they've gone from third to eighth, 16 points from 14 games in Serie A since we discussed Sass. Real Sociedad have gone from first to sixth, 15 points from 13 games. Villarreal from second to fifth with 18 points from 13 since we recorded. And then Southampton, of course, the Premier League team that we looked at, three wins, four draws and seven defeats since then, 13 points from 14. They've dropped eight places from fourth to 12th. So I had the word overachievers in my head, and then another word popped in, outliers. And I thought, what a great way to set Tom and Michael to work for this week's pod. I want to know who the outliers are on a number of different statistical and tactical levels across Europe. I want to know which teams are laughing in the face of the underlying numbers and which teams are making sacrifices at the altar of expected goals, begging for mercy, but also some tactical stuff from Michael as well. So with that in mind, let's work our way through Europe's outliers in terms of football teams. And Michael, we'll start with two teams that you watched this weekend. Convenient that. Two of the Premier League's outliers in many ways.
Yeah, Saturday 3 p.m. I watched Burnley against Brighton, which to be honest wasn't a great decision because it meant I missed Newcastle-Southampton, which was far more action-packed. But I think it's fair to say if you choose to watch Burnley, you're not expecting much action anyway. I think both of these teams, I should say, fit into what we're talking about today. They are complete outliers in different ways. Burnley, I think, are the obvious examples in many ways. I mean, they play 4-4-2. They very much play long ball. I think that is an interesting factor with Nick Pope, who probably would be the England goalkeeper if he wasn't playing in a side where he can't prove his distribution skills. But the stat I found that I really like about Burnley is very niche. And it's one of these ones that comes from FB Ref, which is our new go-to source for football stats. And one of the things that they record is whether corners are in-swingers or out-swingers, which I absolutely love because it's a very clear thing that, you know, you don't really have much of a perception of, maybe apart from your own team. So I was looking at the numbers for this. So the average across Europe's major five leagues, each team plays an average of 37% of their corners in swingers. The second highest across the top five leagues is Tottenham, who play 64% of their corners as in swingers. But Burnley play 84% of their corners as in swingers, which is just way out in front of everyone else. And I had a look into the stats for this. It's, as you might expect, it's Westwood from the left with his right foot, and then McNeil from the right with his left foot, or Brady or Peters if McNeil isn't playing. And I thought this was interesting because it's notable that Ashley Westwood has actually scored from a couple of corners over the past couple of seasons. You don't see that very much. Mm. Although actually I did see one at the weekend with Chelsea's concession in the WSL game, straight from a corner. But it's just, I mean, if Burnley are the only team who are playing in swinging corners this regularly, they're the only team who really are going to score direct from corners. It's probably not what they're generally trying. But I did think it was interesting that they are basically way out in front of everyone else in that respect. And Brighton as well, I mean, a slightly different example, and Tom might have further stats on this, but I think a lot of people will know that Burnley are very much underperforming compared to their XG. And I was looking at the kind of precise breakdown of the shots. And the stat that jumped out at me was from the top five leagues, they've got the lowest percentage of their shots that go on target. And, you know, it's not like they're being fooled by brilliant goalkeeping again and again. It's that they're not hitting the target. 25% of their shots go on target. The average is 34%. The highest is 42%, which to my great surprise is Everton, just ahead of Barcelona. I don't know if there's some kind of Ronald Koeman effect going on with those clubs. But I just think it's interesting about Brighton because we often talk about XG and underperforming as being unlucky or that it will kind of even out in the end. But I just think Brighton have got a lot of players who are very good at linking play, great at pressing, really good movement, but they're just not good finishers. I think Danny Welbeck is the perfect example of that, along with players like Mope and Connolly. Even Trossard has been used up front. He's a really good player, great all-round attacker, but he's not a great finisher. So I wonder whether this is something we will see over a longer period from Brighton. You know, I think still we're a very good side, but they're just not very clinical in front of goal. And I think that might just be the characteristics of their players.
I mean, they've just had what's been described as the best week in the club's history, of course, beating Spurs and beating Liverpool as well. Tom, are they still outliers in expected goals terms? I tweeted after their win against Liverpool that they're kind of reaping what they sowed earlier in the season in XG terms, which might have been spectacularly missing the point, but I got around 50 likes for it, so I'm not that bothered if it is.
That's pretty good, Ali. I know we all judge our lives on the metrics, which is favourites on Twitter, so that would have made me extremely happy. I hope Andy Naylor on a Brighton piece at the weekend, and it was really interesting to kind of dig into their XG numbers in the recent fixtures versus the rest of the season as a whole. And it was a great example where, like, Brighton were under their XG in the games up to the recent kind of period, and they were also under their XG in those games as well. So they scored 3 goals from 6 XG. So it wasn't like they, you know, went on a finishing tear. It was just defensively, they were really solid. And for once, you know, Robert Sanchez in goal saved the shots, and Matt Ryan, when he was in goal for them, actually obviously conceded a lot more than was expected of him. So yeah, I think Michael's making a great point around, like, finishing wise they aren't the best in front of goal. And I was looking at some data from Smarter Scout, which has a kind of finishing model which looks at kind of if you control for the quality of the chance, if you control for the goalkeeper, because goalkeepers, if you're going up against one who's terrible, you are going to score more than average. And their model kind of shows that Trossard, Mopay, I think Welbeck as well, and Connolly are all kind of subpar finishers, and kind of below the average strikers. So they are good at other elements of their game, but maybe not the best at finishing their chances. But yeah, it's really interesting to see that Brighton finally picking up some wins, and they were definitely deserved wins. And again, kind of reaping the rewards of just, you know, they've been playing well all season. And it's something that, I mean, Andy Naylor put in the piece that technical director Dan Ashworth and the higher ups at the club have been telling Potter all season, keep playing like this and we'll get results. And that was a week when finally the coin flips came up heads for them.
So they're still, with 24 goals scored from 30.7 expected, the Premier League's great underperformers in terms of expected goals for. Across Europe, who else stands out? Who are the other outliers in this sense, Tom?
So yeah, for the rest of these, and I guess the rest of the data on this pod, I kind of picked one team, kind of the top or bottom team for each league. So in Italy, we have Udinese, and they've scored 21 goals from 27.9 XG, so that's a difference of nearly 7 goals. And I think a lot of it comes down to Kevin Lasagna, and I was trying to find a good lasagna pun. We could say that lasagna is frozen or something like that in front of goal, but I think he has the largest underperformance of all players in Europe at the moment. I think he scored 2 goals from around 8 XG, which isn't great, of course. Then you've got Mainz, who scored 19 from 25.4 XG, and they've just lost their most clinical striker in Gianfilippo Mateta on Leeds Palace. And then lastly, Alaves have scored 18 from 25.6 XG. So a lot of these are teams that are more towards the bottom of the leagues or quite low scoring. But at the top, actually, you've got Lyon, who have scored 46 goals. Their XG is close to 54, so that's a swing of about 8 that they're under. Lyon are obviously a really good quality team. They made the Champions League semi-final last season, but they're a team this season who are actually slightly under their numbers.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Okay, let's focus on the positives. I guess if it is a positive, and there's probably some debate about this, but let's talk about the overperformances in terms of XG across Europe. Tom, who are our outliers in this sense? I'm looking at the list and I can see some of the biggest teams in world football and Montpellier.
Yeah, it's always a nice surprise when you see a bit of a smaller team up there, and it goes to show that finishing doesn't just belong to those who are obviously good teams or good players. You can actually have smaller teams that are up there as well. But Montpellier scored 39 from around 30 XG. A lot of that is driven by Andy Delors, who famously used to play for Wigan Athletic, and Gaetan Laborde up front, both of which are kind of blowing away XG in terms of how many goals they've scored. And then elsewhere, you've got Atleti, who, I mean, 27.3 XG is below Montpellier. It's below Man United, who's on this list, Napoli as well. They don't create all that many good chances, but they've had the excellent finishing of a really, you know, informed Luis Suarez so far this season, and they scored 41 goals. And then right at the top as well, you've got Bayern, of course, Bayern have spearheaded by Robert Lewandowski. Thomas Müller is back amongst the goals this season. Both of those have meant they've scored 58 goals from 43.5 XG. So that's a swing of about 15 goals, which is huge. And then at the other end, I mean, a couple of teams which I didn't expect to see Man U here, but Man U have scored 47 from 39 and Napoli 44 from 36. And I think Napoli were a team that we spoke about last time or in a previous podcast because they just take so many shots. I think they're averaging 20 shots per game, which is the most in Europe. So obviously they've still got some decent finishing talent in that squad with Dries Mertens. I think Lorenzo Insigne historically is a decent finisher as well. So in amongst the big teams and Montpellier.
Love it. Shot monster Gennaro Gattuso of managing Napoli at the moment. Michael, when I asked you to find some interesting things for my outliers idea here, I was prepared for all sorts. I was certainly hoping for some quirkiness. You started by telling me about in-swinging corners, which is pretty much the dream start. But when you told me that you want to talk also about Everton's free kick defending, that just went beyond my expectations.
Yeah, so Everton have been defending wide free kicks, I would say, in a completely different way to every other side in Europe, which is quite strange. For those who haven't seen it, rather than defending in one solid line, kind of holding an offside line relatively high at the pitch, they're retreating almost onto the edge of their six-yard box in kind of two banks of four and trying to attack the ball coming forward rather than going back to defend it. And they have been doing that for most of this season. I think only two or three games they've taken the more traditional approach. But it was interesting, or it was significant at the weekend, because they conceded a goal to Manchester United from a Luke Shaw free kick into Scott McTominay. And that was notable because the goalkeeper, Robin Olsen, really made a meal of it in a way that I haven't really seen before. It seemed like he slipped, but the more you watch it, it almost is just like he's just unaccustomed to having to react so late to something and ends up just kind of falling over rather than diving towards the ball. I mean, they did a little bit, Jamie Carragher did a bit about it on Monday Night Football, and I thought, you know, he made the point that actually that was their first concession of the season. So it's not like this is disastrous for them. But it does feel to me like the kind of thing that might be almost worked out. You know, there's a reason why no other side defend those wide free kicks like that. And having watched a few of them back, early on, a lot of the free kick takers almost didn't know where to put the free kick, because I think you're so used to putting it in behind the defence, curling it into that zone, that you almost need to adjust to put it in a different place. And that's what Shaw did very well. He put it almost between the two lines. McTominay got a bit of a free header. So I just thought that was interesting. I haven't seen any side defend a wide free kick like that for a long time. Maybe never. But it's not a kind of a hallmark of Ancelotti's tactics. It seems specific for Everton. Maybe, a perceived weakness for Jordan Pickford not wanting to come out and defend that space. He's not the biggest goalkeeper, as we know. But yeah, after that concession, I think it's certainly something to watch out for, because opponents will be trying to do the same thing as Manchester United.
That's The Athletic's set-piece defending correspondent, Michael Cox, there. You can find him on Twitter, Zonal Marking, interestingly enough. Zonal Marking, if you want to ask him any further questions. That's really interesting, something to keep an eye on, definitely, that Everton set-piece defending. Tom, I also wanted to use you here to basically tell me which team's matches I should be watching. There's so much football available to watch at the moment, and it can be hard to choose between matches that are on at the same time. So I sent you away to tell me who the entertainers were in terms of highest XG combined per game, because I don't just want to see a dominant side. I don't want to just see attack versus defence. And also who I should be avoiding here in terms of who has the lowest XG per game combined. So what are the results?
Yeah, Ali, I think I largely failed the first task, apart from one team, which was my saving grace, which is Leeds United. So Leeds have got the highest kind of combined XG in a game on average in the Premier League this season with 3.4 XG. The rest of the teams on the list are teams that are very kind of top heavy. You've got Bayern Munich, you've got Barcelona, PSG and Milan as well. So Leeds are the only team that lists who, you know, their actual XG for and against is pretty balanced. So you are going to see a far more probably entertaining and, yeah, again, like I guess balanced game with Leeds United. At the lower end, though, it is a bit easier. I mean, you've got Getafe, which 1.8 XG on average is just eyeballing the numbers now, about 0.3 less than any other team, which is about 15% lower than all of the low teams anyway. So unless you like really steely, chanceless football, Getafe may not be for you. You got Wolves in there as well, which I think it's quite interesting and definitely passed the eye test this season that they are far more defence first outfit, and they have players in Daniel Podence and Pedro Neto, who's a wonderful talent, to stage attacks. But I think that they haven't really had that, you know, since Raul Jimenez has been injured, they've not really had that centrepiece to build around. Although William Jose was definitely a bit of a nuisance against Arsenal last week. And then elsewhere, you've got Lille and Leverkusen. Leverkusen, for me, are a bit of an interesting one. One I maybe would double check, just because they feel, from memory, like a fun side on paper with, you know, Leon Bailey, Moussa Diaby, very much like have the tools to be a fun side, but similarly from this lens, not. And then Parma. I mean, Parma are a fun side because they've fielded more players than any other in Europe this season. So if you want to watch a game less for, I guess, the chances and more just a game of guess who for the team sheet, that's probably the better option.
I wonder why that is. I wonder whether James Horncastle has written about Parma, and if not, could we get a request in to him to do that as soon as possible? Love that. Just Getafe living so much up to expectations with 1.82 combined XG per game. Miserable stuff, but also wonderful in its own way. Okay, if XG combined four only chucked up basically the best teams in each division, Leeds not included, what about total shots combined, Tom? Seems like maybe a slightly simpler metric this, but I want to know which teams' matches feel most like basketball matches.
I mean, Leeds are in there again with 29 shots on average, which is the most in Europe. So again, I think that they're going to take home the gold medal in this instance for sure. But you've also got Schalke, who I feel Schalke are kind of the kid who, you know, constantly gets beaten up for his lunch money. They're doing really badly in the league this season, and again, I'd posit that a lot of those shots are them conceding them. So yeah, Schalke are another one in there. Valencia, another side, 25 shots on average and most in La Liga. But I mean, I think the other one, and we've touched on them before, is Sassuolo under De Zerbi with 28 shots in a match on average. I think they themselves have a really fun start of play and a kind of a pep lights to some extent, but also, you know, if you like shots, you like attacking football that's leading to shots, I think Sassuolo's games are a great option. On the flip side, teams which you're going to see, you know, less shots of, and arguably they're more of a, not even necessarily a tactical battle, but more of a territorial battle, are the likes of Cologne, Getafe again, Southampton, Spezia and Marseille, who combined have the least shots in a game on average. Marseille particularly a good example because they have the highest number of yellow cards on average as well. So with the recent news around Andres Villas-Boas, I think that's a great combination of no shots and lots of yellows, potentially means that it's not an overly happy dressing room.
Right, I want to inject some Michael Cox into proceedings. Michael, you've basically picked out five or six teams total for us here. Who's next on the list in terms of quirky outliers?
Yeah, so I quite like Wolfsburg for quite a niche reason, and that's because they play a midfield trio who are all left-footed. And I know you like stuff like this, Ali. We chatted earlier in the season about Leicester playing 11 right-footers. Well, Wolfsburg are very much the opposite. They've got a midfield trio of Schlager, Gerhard, and Max Arnold, who I was amazed to see was only 26, because it feels like he's been around for about a decade. But yeah, they're all left-footed. They also have John Brooks, who people probably remember as a US international. He's very good on the ball, plays to the left side of the defensive pairing. Tom has previously explained why that is considered so valuable in the modern game to have a left footer there. And Castells in goal, a Belgian goalkeeper, he's also left footed. So it means overall, Wolfsburg are the only side in Europe's major five leagues who play more left footed passes than right footed passes, which I think is a really great niche little stat. Second on the list, if you are interested, is going to become very popular in this podcast, is Leeds United. I mean, looking at their side, Melier in goal is left-footed. Strike and Cooper are as well. Obviously, Alioski, the left-back. But then you've got the fact that both Rafinha and Harrison, the two wingers, are both left-footed. They play different roles. Harrison usually going down the flank and crossing, staying wide, and Rafinha coming inside and shooting. And Bamford up front, who is pretty two-footed, actually, does prefer his left. So they have another couple of midfielders, particularly Phillips and Click, and Ayling as well is very involved in the build-up play. Those are right-footers, so that's why they don't have, the overall number of passes are slightly more swayed to the right-footers. But actually, they often play 7 out of 11 left-footers, which is probably getting up there to be a record, I would think.
Yeah, Rodrigo as well. I'm not sure you mentioned him, but he also favours his left foot. I'd love to know with regards to Wolfsburg, whether they are heavily weighted towards attacking down the left side, because you could see with that midfield trio that might lend itself to focusing down that side.
Yeah, I looked that up, and actually there's no real imbalance in terms of the size that they attack down. I also had a look at their shots, and actually they don't score many left-footed shots, only 7 of their 32 goals this year, which puts them roughly mid-table in a table of left-footed goals. So it really is just about the build-up play, and particularly the midfield trio. But no, in terms of how they attack, it doesn't really seem to affect them at all.
Okay, let's take a look at pressing here, Tom. If I asked you to find me some pressing outliers from across European football, what have you got for me?
So the most are kind of the usual suspects here. You've got Bayern, who, I mean, we're looking at press rate here, which is proportion of touches that the opposition has in the middle and their own defensive third that are quote-unquote pressured. And that's using, again, stats from data from FBref. Bayern press a third of opponent touches in that area. After that, you've got Leeds and Liverpool, who are kind of the Premier League leaders. Again, the Leeds siren is going off in the background. Paris Saint-Germain, interestingly, under, I guess, a hybrid of Tuchel and Pochettino this season, are still an extremely high pressing side domestically, and just seem to dominate games anyway with possession. Atalanta up there as well under Gasperini, which, I mean, he's had a bit of a change in personnel. We've obviously seen Papu Gomez now leave to go to Sevilla, but he still has a very kind of regimented system, which, you know, no player is either bigger than the team, and the roles are kind of transcendent across, you know, who's actually playing in the team. So they are still a very high pressing side and have been for a few years. As are Eibar, which I guess they haven't really pushed on, and it'd be interesting to look into. Maybe it's a pod topic for another time, but it feels in the Premier League you get levels of progression where a team can kind of get promoted, consolidate itself in mid-table, then maybe push on further upfield. And it seems that in Spain, potentially with Eibar, that just hasn't really happened, and they're kind of there or thereabouts every season. But still, again, they've been a really high-pressing side for a number of seasons now. And then the non-pressers, the ones who are far more passive out of possession. In the Premier League, you've got West Brom, West Ham and Wolves with a press rate which is the lowest in the league, which is fantastic and shows you that, you know, if Wickham Wanderers were promoted, they'd probably be in that group as well. It seems that
they probably are in championship terms. I think they'd probably fit the bill here too.
Perfect. So yeah, I wonder if there's a team that are going to buck that trend at some point, or they're just bound to it through the laws of the universe. You then have in the Bundesliga Union Berlin, who are one of the lower pressing sides by this measure, which is quite interesting. I was speaking to Christoph Biermann about this, who regularly does the podcast with Rafa Honigstein with The Athletic, and he was kind of saying they didn't overly pass the eye test. Christoph kind of he's written a book last season where he was kind of embedded with the Union Berlin team and you know, the board, and got a really good insight into all the decisions made. And he was kind of saying to me that they think that they press and disagree with the fact that they're so low on this. So Union are, you know, potentially an outlier that shouldn't be an outlier potentially. And then you've also got Montpellier as well, which are similar to West Ham here. And you can see that there's definitely some stylistic differences. And perhaps that's why we saw Delors and Gaëtan Laborde linked to West Ham in January. And then the other two teams in Spain and Italy, respectively, are Elche and Benevento as well. I think Pipo Inzaghi is the Benevento manager. Very different approach to kind of pressing and defending out of possession to his brother at Lazio.
I wonder what Benevento's offsides stats are with Pipo Inzaghi in charge. That's probably low-hanging fruit there, but I couldn't resist.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to michelobultra.com/courtside to learn more.
okay, I want to know in terms of style with the ball. We've just heard about pressing. We've learned about the teams who are most active in trying to win the ball back high up the pitch, and those at the other end of the spectrum with more of a focus on defensive structure, if you will. What about with the ball, Tom? I'm thinking who has the lowest possession percentage or something like that, but a very, very effective style of play. Who scores a lot of goals without having much of the ball, essentially?
Yeah, so the way I like to tackle this one was just look at all teams who have less than 45% possession on average and then just look at who scores the most goals. And from that, we have Freiburg and Union Berlin, who have 44% possession on average and score 1.7 goals per game, which is the highest of any team kind of in Europe and seemingly make them some of the better, I guess, not necessarily anti-possession, but one of the better teams which you know, have little or less of the ball. In the Premier League, that side is West Ham, who have just 41% of the of possession in games, and that's obviously having a fantastic season. And similar to them are, again, Montpellier, who we've mentioned before, and Sampdoria in Serie A as well, who have 43% possession and are scoring kind of, you know, 1.48 1.5 goals a game on average, which is a pretty decent number given the possession that they have. So those are the teams which are, I guess, effective without the ball or with little of the ball. On the flip side, you've got kind of RB Leipzig, Betis, Nice, Chelsea and Sassuolo, who seemingly dominate possession and have over 55% of the ball on average, but actually score fewer goals than teams in that kind of group. Nice are a great example where they kind of dominate the ball, and they've always seemingly dominated the ball or looked to under Patrick Vieira. Now, obviously, Vieira left his post earlier in the season, but the stats haven't really changed too much. They're still quite a low-scoring side. They've played a lot of players this season. They've got a very young team, and trying to kind of drill into them some sort of possession play, but seemingly it doesn't really return many goals, and it's not as fruitful as other sides. RB Leipzig was an interesting one for me, where again we're seeing a further evolution of that team under Julian Nagelsmann. They're maybe not as prolific as other possession dominant sides, but they definitely have kind of changed their style that way and are potentially a bit less direct. And then of course we have Chelsea under this kind of Frank Lampard, Thomas Tuchel Frankenstein of a team at the moment, which we'll hopefully see more of the fruits of Tuchel's work in the next few weeks and the coming months. But so far, based on the stats of this season at the moment, have been kind of one of the more low-scoring, high-possession sides.
Mm. Okay, interesting stuff. My general sort of hopes and dreams for this pod being fulfilled, because I think I'm probably safe to say that a lot of people listening to this podcast love to find quirky teams, interesting teams tactically or analytically, and then can dive in and do a bit more research of their own and can try and watch some of the film, of course. And, you know, across the last half an hour, you've really told me about a lot of teams that I want to watch more of, that's for sure. Michael, to finish us off, you've picked out a couple of sides that have caught your eye, not necessarily at the very top or bottom of various metrics, but still got this kind of quirky nature.
Again, we're looking at stats that they're particularly interesting to me, because it's relatively recently that we've been able to get really detailed information on pressing and where teams win the ball and where teams make tackles. So there's a couple of interesting ones. Elche in La Liga, they're 19th in the league, had a really weird season. They won 3 of their first 5 games. They haven't won since then. Jorge Almiron has kept his job, maybe slightly surprisingly. The interesting thing here is that they've got the 6th highest pass completion rate in La Liga. Only Barcelona, Real Madrid, Sevilla, Villarreal and Atletico have completed a higher percentage of their passes. So they seem a very technical side. But then the odd thing is that their possession share is under 50%, which is only the 11th highest in La Liga. So I went and had a look at that and why. And it's because they just don't win back possession quickly enough. On average, a side attempts about 12% of their tackles in the final third, goes up to about 19% for Bayern, Dortmund and Liverpool. But Elche's is only 4%, which is really, really low. And you can look at it the other way. They've made 62% of their tackles in their own third. The average is 49%. So in Europe, they're the side that sit the deepest by this measure, soak up pressure rather than trying to press. But then when they win the ball, they don't counter-attack. They kind of just play possession football. It doesn't seem to have been particularly effective, and I must say I haven't seen much of Elche this season aside from highlights, but it's certainly a very unusual approach, and yeah, fits into them being outliers.
I love that. It feels very counterintuitive, right, based on general tactical discourse and things that are generally accepted as given in tactical terms. Like, nothing wrong with defending deep, nothing wrong with trying to cause or create, I guess, space to play into in transition. And here's Elche, who do that bit very, very well, but have absolutely no interest in hitting the opposition on the counter. I wonder if that's to do with personnel. Maybe they don't have speed up top. It'd be great to hear from anyone who's watched a lot of Elche to know why they are making this, as I say, potentially counterintuitive decision. What about a team in France that you flagged up to us?
Yeah, Nîmes, they're almost the reverse. As you can tell, I'm a bit obsessed with sides that win the ball in different thirds of the pitch at the moment.
And set piece again, defending.
Oh, of course, but that's been a long-standing obsession. That's going back decades. Yeah, I mean, again, looking at a list of the teams who have the highest percentage of their tackles in the final third is Bayern Munich, Liverpool, Dortmund, Inter, Man City, Atalanta, all what you'd expect. And then there's Nîmes who are up there. And they're a complete outlier because they're very good at winning the ball high up the pitch. But whereas those aforementioned sides score a lot of goals and win a lot of games, Nîmes have only scored 20 goals in 23 games. And they're bottom of Ligue 1. They recently sacked their manager after a 3-0 loss to PSG, which seems a bit of a harsh time to go. I mean, clearly they're just losing game after game after game. But going after losing 3-0 to PSG must be quite gutting, I think, for Jérôme Arpinon. But yeah, Nîmes, I mean, having a look more at their stats, the reason they don't score many is they just don't shoot much. And they also shoot from really long range compared to most sides. So they're a side who win the ball really high up, but then shoot from quite far out, which I just think is quite an amusing combination. It just seems to be based around pressing first and not much of a plan with the ball. And you may or may not remember, but this is the second time I've mentioned Nîmes in recent weeks, because in a previous pod when we were looking at midfield roles, I was trying to find someone who qualifies as an Argentine number five, and I found this guy called Andres Cubas, who's Argentine born but plays for Paraguay or has played once for Paraguay. And I mentioned the fact that he has a really high number of tackles but doesn't shoot much at all. And I think that is what we expect from the Nîmes side, who are very good at pressing high up but don't score many goals.
Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Well, thank you, both of you. I set you this sort of scouting mission, I suppose, if you will, for the pod this week, and you've not let me down. So a beautiful bit of podcasting from both of you on outliers across Europe from a tactical, statistical, data analytical perspective. As ever, we've been the Zonal Marking Podcast, brought to you by The Athletic. Michael and Tom work so hard to write such interesting football content. And if you're listening to this podcast, then you know that already. And if you listen to this podcast and you're not a subscriber of The Athletic, it feels to me like something slightly counterintuitive. You are the Elche of podcast listeners, dare I say it. So do sign up, theathletic.com/zonalmarking. We'll be back again next week. Please do join us. Make sure you're subscribed. Have a great rest of your week, and we'll talk again next time.
The Athletic.